My name is Howard Olson. I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota. I've been a church layman for many years, and I spent my career mainly in the wood preservative chemical industry. After I retired a few years ago, I worked for a Lutheran nursing home in St. Paul. It was owned by 25 congregations as a foundation director and fundraiser. I'm a forestry graduate, and I was appointed by the governor of Minnesota recently to be on a commission to study forests and forest products as they relate to long-time planning in Minnesota, and that's been a very interesting commission for me to be part of. The commission's made up of all aspects of the people interested in forestry, from bird watchers, hunters and fishermen, to loggers and professional people in the industrial paper makers and such. Well, we get into some pretty heavy stuff here, you know. So I've told the groups before, last year too, that the only thing you can do when the catastrophe is facing America is to keep your sense of humor. And the spotted owl was mentioned and brought to mind the story about a guy came to Minnesota from South Dakota, and our state bird there is a loon. You all heard of the loon? And it's unlawful to shoot the loon. So this guy shot the loon, and he got caught by the game warden. So the game warden said, "Now, what was it? You shot the loon and all this and that?" And he said, "Yeah, he didn't realize it was a state bird." So the game warden got kind of curious. He said, "Well, what did you do with it?" He said, "I ate it." So the game warden thought a little while longer, and he thought, "Hey, wasn't he so funny?" He asked him, "Say, what'd that taste like?" He says, "Well, it was somewhere between a bald eagle and a whooping crane." That's the way it is in Minnesota. What I've done, there's so much put together now on acid rain. 2-3 years ago, we didn't hear the word very much, and since then, we're finally getting enough publicity on it. And there's some very fine literature, and there's so much of it that it's very difficult for an evening like this, where we only have 45 or 50 minutes to bring it all to your attention. I've tried to scan the literature. I've got some of the reproductions here that you're welcome to come up and read and look at afterward. But what I'd like to do is read some of the introductions that are in the literature here, and then we can talk about what it is, where it is, the damage it's causing, and how much of it there is, and what we can do about it. And the way we conduct these sessions at Holden is we get into, if you have questions or comments, please feel free to bring them up. And then near the end of the hour, we'd like to get down to some issues. And I just jotted a couple here. You may have better ideas than this, but should the church take a position on such a serious matter as acid rain? How can we promote better policies as individuals? And I always end up with the word advocate, that we, if we want to make our influence known, we can be advocates for this, that, or the other thing. I'm going to put this up now because this talks about acid rain and the fish. Can you see that from where you're sitting there? Are your bifocals working all right and everything? I didn't get them today. But the important thing here is the pH scale that runs across the bottom here, and that's what the whole subject is all about.
Is the pH? All the light
that you have. It's too bad. We should have a couple of spotlights here, and I have to apologize for it. But I guess we can just come up here and look at it later on if you want to. But I'll put this up here. The pH scale. The way that goes is the way that influences everything that's caused by acid rain. And they've changed the terms even now. They call it acid deposition as much as rain, because a lot of the deposits might land on the soil or on the trees or on the lakes before they are brought down by rainfall or snowfall. So as a matter of introduction, I'm just going to read a couple of things here that I think introduce the subject quite well. This one that I'm going to read from is to show you how serious the matter is a white paper on the forest effects of air pollution. This is put out by the American Forestry Association. It's excellent reading, and it's a very well done paper. They worked on it for several years before they finished it, just to give you an idea of how important this is to many agencies. Mankind has always valued the rain. Plentiful and timely rains assure good crops and abundant water supplies. Summer rains are refreshing. Spring rains help recharge aquifers and cleanse groundwaters. Autumn rains and winter snow cleanse the air. With rain comes a sense of hope, vitality, and a promise of the future. Over the last decades, however, in many areas of the nation and the world, simple rainfall has taken on a new and threatening complexity. In these localities, the rain is no longer benign, for here the rain must pass through an atmosphere polluted with sulfur oxides and nitrogen oxides. Such atmospheric oxides do occur naturally and have, in past partnership with the rain, become part of nature's balance. But it's the oxides from unnatural sources, man-made industries, power plants, auto exhausts, and other fossil fuel combustible materials that have disrupted that partnership and upset the balance. The falling rain and snow now react with the oxide pollutants to produce precipitation of new chemical properties, often a mixture of sulfuric acid, nitric acid, and water, a far cry from pure rain or clean snow. And it has become acid precipitation or acid rain. That was that introduction. This other introduction starts off a little differently. It says, of all the factors that can stress forest ecosystems, air pollution is one of the newest that trees and other aquatic forest resources have had to accommodate. Air pollutants can add to a short-term or prolonged environmental stress over the complex of interacting natural stresses. Most forest stresses involve natural substances or situations that a forest encounters and accommodates on a daily basis. The situation that caused various stresses can be categorized as biological, physical, or chemical. Biological factors include fungi, viruses, and insects. Physical factors can involve extremes of heat and cold, nutrient and moisture supply, geographical locations, wildfires, human activities, such as prescribed burning or logging. One of the other catastrophes is Mount St. Helens that erupted a few years ago out here. Chemical factors include natural and man-made gases such as sulfur dioxide, nitrogen, and ozone. Metals such as aluminum, mercury, and lead, acidic and acid-forming substances such as sulfuric and nitric acids and ammonium ions, and growth-altering organic chemicals such as ethylene. The combined effect of these stresses controls the health and productivity of the aquatic forest resources. Now, as you read into this, you think about the rain and everything, but more and more, some of the better and deeper research is showing that we're getting quite a bit of deposition on the soil itself, and that won't be showing up for a number of years until the soil moisture and other rain and other moisture brings in the acidic stage. And what it's doing is damaging the soil for new seedlings and generation of crops as well as trees. This far, the emphasis has been on forests, but I can assure you that when it begins to hit agricultural crops and production, you're going to see a different amount of publicity in the press and everywhere else, and the pressure on Congress to do something about it. Because if your yield of corn drops from 100 bushels an acre down to 80 bushels an acre, you begin to notice in a big hurry and it gets the public's attention. In forestry, where they've been had some good studies going in New England, where they've been able to show that the growth in cords per acre is either stopped or is about half of what it normally was in the preceding 10-year period, they know that the trees are not growing as fast as they were previously. Now, what is acid rain and where does it come from? Guess I've said a little bit about sulfur dioxide. Sulfur dioxide and the nitrous oxides come from the combustion of oil and coal, but since the energy situation in 1973, many of the utilities went to using a lot of soft coal, much of it from the West, shipping it back to the Midwest. We have these coal trains coming in Minnesota from Wyoming that never stop rolling. They get filled while they're moving, and they're still moving when they're getting unloaded at Becker, Minnesota. The reason I keep talking about utilities is that the utility industry on sulfur dioxide accounts for 66% of what's put into the air. It's kind of lulling, you know, you read all these stats as you go along, and it says so many million tons of this, so many million tons of that, and you kind of pass it over in your reading. But just for a little more graphic thing today, I show you this. It says 24 million tons a year of sulfur dioxide are put into the air. That's along with the nitrous, beyond the nitrous oxides. So I just took, you know, that's 24 million tons. Well, that's something. That's 2 million tons a month. Well, that's something too, you know, 2 million tons a month. So just so you can understand it, that's 500,000 tons each week. Well, there's 20 tons in an 18-wheel truck, 40,000 pounds, 20 tons. In a boxcar, you got 40 tons, right? That's 25,000 truckloads. I just do this little arithmetic for you. You've all been on the highways and seen the congestion. If you could think of 25,000 18-wheelers going down the highway, and that's how much we're pouring out into the atmosphere every week, week after week after week. It gives you a little more, it doesn't mean anything, it gives me a little more vivid sense of what we're talking about. And it's going to get worse. That's the reason I think this is such kind of a vital subject when you talk about something of that scope, and it's not going to get any better, it's going to get any worse. So what's being done about it? Without being political, during the Reagan years, little or nothing was done, if anything less was done than had been done under Carter in the U.S. And Reagan kept saying, we want to study it some more, we want to get some more facts and figures, which probably you need. Now for a minute I want to tell you how, why it came to everybody's attention, first in Europe. Since you're from Norway, and we mentioned the other day about 4 months ago, we had a group of Swedish foresters at the University of Minnesota, and I was invited to attend their symposium. Sweden has the greatest forest production per acre of any country in the world. And if you've studied forestry, the three enemies of the forest, along with drought, but the three main enemies are fire, insect attack, and disease, fungi that'll kill the trees. Almost all of the forest research that's been done over the last 50 years has been directed toward those three enemies of the forest, how we can improve it, suppress it, and do better. Now, all of a sudden, the greatest threat to Swedish forestry is acid rain. And it's not coming from Sweden. It's coming from Poland. They get it both ways. It comes from Poland, and it comes from London. No matter which way the wind's blowing, it hits Sweden up here. It is so severe in Sweden that they've already seen it's been reducing the growth per acre. They have excellent records, but Sweden in 1903 passed a law that when you cut down one tree, you have to plant two, and they hopefully one of them to grow. That's why they're, with intensive forest management like that, that's why they've got such good production today. It's so severe in Sweden that they are seriously considering paying for the installation of scrubbers on the stacks of Polish industry. If you can imagine an international situation that is getting a lot of debate and attention, you imagine how that would be handled. One country is going to go over to another third world country and say, we'll put these scrubbers at millions of dollars expense so that all your refuse won't be blowing onto our forests here. The other example I'd like to tell you about is my cousin in Norway has a lake place quite far up in the mountains, and I was there in 1981. And he told me about the lake there was dead. And I questioned that, and he said that there's no fish or anything there. And I was back in Norway this summer. And in the interim period, they've been bringing lime up to that lake on snowmobiles in the winter and spreading it on the ice. And then said later on, they also put lime in by helicopter or aircraft. And now they've been able to bring that back, that lake back to life by putting fish back in there and fingerlings. And those are the kind of situations we face. And it's the same in Norway. They're still getting, they're getting that pollution from another source. Without going too much further into all those details, you've all been reading about what's happened in New England, where the Canadians are blaming the Americans for all this blowing from Ohio Valley and the high stacks over to Canada. And in the Adirondacks, the best research in America has been done in the Adirondacks. The state of New York has a very extensive state park system, and the Adirondack State Park is one of their biggest ones. And they've got survey plots there. They've been checking very closely for about 18 to 20 years now. And when you read about those results, it is really catastrophic. It's scary because they're killing a lot of trees. They're hurting the soil, so it can't be brought back. And what doesn't stop in New England is blowing on into Canada. So the Canadians are very, very up on that. And this publication is put out by the Canadian government, the Acid Rain Story. And it starts right at the beginning. It says, acid rain is a fairly recent addition to our language, but this phenomenon, acid precipitation and deposition, may in fact date back to the Industrial Revolution of the late 18th century, has become a recognized problem for scientists since the 1950s, and for the last decade has a major concern that continues to defile major areas of our planet. And they go into the various breakdown on a summary, and I'll just read you a few stats out of here of what's happened to Canada. They go ahead, everybody recognizes the same two main ingredients are nitric acid and sulfuric acid. The pH scale, as I mentioned here, is determined degree of acidity or alkalinity of a solution. Clean rain is slightly acidic with a pH of about 5.6. Below this level, precipitation is considered abnormally acidic. More than 2 million square miles of North America now receive rain with a pH of 4.6 or lower. That is 10 or more times as acidic as clean rain. As you know, the pH scale is logarithmic, so it's many times, multiplied by many times.
So what's the pH stand for?
Who wants to answer? You want to answer?
It's just another term for the acidity.
Acidity. The neutral is 7.
Yeah. It has a scale of 14.
As it goes down, it gets lower, it gets more acidic. As it goes up, it gets less.
It gets more alkaline.
And this one says ammonia is 1.1, milk of magnesia, let's see, baking soda, where are we here? The vinegar, I think, is about 3. And they've checked some rainfall in Canada that is lower than vinegar, 2.6. That's getting pretty acidic. It's not acid enough to hurt humans yet, but it could be eventually. And it'll hurt the people that have respiratory situations. In Denver, tell me about that for a minute. Just to have someone else talk.
Oh, well, I was just going to mention that there is a drinking water standard for acidity. And that's anywhere, it runs from about 6 to about 8.5. And there's the standards for aquatic life, and that's what they show yep. up there. When you exceed the standards for aquatic life, then the fish die. And in Denver, it's just it's automobile exhausts that are the principal
and they
thing
get,
of acid rain in the Denver area. But smelters like a copper smelter can cause acid rain. It isn't just the utilities. It's a lot of any industry that puts sulfur or nitrogen compounds into the atmosphere.
Sudbury, Ontario in Canada. Have any of you been there?
Mm-hmm.
I've been there. I went there many, many years ago, and It's like being on the surface of the moon or somewhere like that.
Exactly. Downwind, it's like a, like the moon.
And they kept building the stack higher and higher. It blew out further, didn't it? It still came down. I think they said that stack is higher now than the highest building in America, higher than the Sears Tower. 700 feet or something like that.
Which is the bigger culprit, big industry or the our driving, our cars?
It varies in certain places, but the stats they have on the sulfur dioxide, they claim that the utility industry, because they burn so much coal, accounts for about 66% of that. But as you said, the smelting industry and other industries also contribute. One thing I haven't been able to figure out, and I think maybe someone here could make a comment about it, is the utility industry is one industry in America that really has a guarantee of profit. If their costs are so high, they can pass it on to the consumer of electricity. And why they're so reluctant to put scrubbers on all their stacks and spend the money cleaning up, I don't know.
Isn't it because they're not sure how they're going to generate energy in the future? They've switched over to coal now, but they're apt to switch back other stores. I know Weyerhaeuser had scrubbers in for the last 20 years.
Sure.
Well, it's also politics over the coal, as he mentioned.
I'm sure there is.
As he mentioned, the western coal has less sulfur than the eastern coal. So he's got trains from Wyoming going to Minnesota. But if you live in West Virginia, and the coal mine is half a mile down the road, are you going to buy the coal there, or are you going to truck it in from Wyoming? Because it's low sulfur.
Isn't it also because of greed?
Greed?
They have to give a good account to the stockholders so that the more dividend they can get from the stockholders, the more satisfied the industry.
Well, that's true with industry. In industry, you're competing with somebody else, and some states have more rigid laws than other states. So in industry, if you're making chemicals or something in Minnesota and they have a tougher regulation than Texas, why, you're at a disadvantage. But in the electric power utility industry, they're, you know, they can guarantee 6% or something on their investment. So they don't have the struggle with the, you know, competition from that standpoint. And still they're the biggest polluters. The other next biggest one of the electric utilities is the automobiles and trucks, diesel. And to answer your question about why the fish weren't biting today, some fish are much more sensitive to acidity than the acid of the water than others. And the regeneration of fish is really sensitive, isn't it? And maybe you'd like to comment on the fact that sometimes the acidity of the water will bring out aluminum from the leaching.
Huh? Yeah, well, there's a couple problems. In the West, the problem isn't as severe because we have a lot of limestone in the West. Limestone naturally buffers, compensates for the acid, decreases the effects of the acid. It's where you have country like in the East or just like here in the North Cascades where there isn't a lot of limestone. We were up at Holden Lake today. It would be susceptible to acid rain because there is a natural buffer. That's why I was talking about liming the lakes. That's what they're doing in New England. They bring truckloads of lime in to raise the pH so that things can live. That's not very economical. And in addition then, as the water becomes more acid on the bottom of the lakes, rivers, what have you, there are a lot of chemicals, principally metals, that are attached to the sediment, the sand particles, the mud particles. As the water becomes more acidic, it releases these metals to the water and causes further pollution. So you've got what they call heavy metal pollution such as aluminum, arsenic, mercury. So you have, it's a twofold problem.
Yeah, because it's releasing and leaching these other chemicals into the lake. So after that, it isn't only the acidity then, is it? You've got other metallic chemicals in the lake. And that's where you get into stage two, where it's not as easy to correct it, regenerate. Yes?
Is this, when you speak of the acidic problem in a lake, does this permeate through the total water supply from the top of the lake to the bottom, like in the sediment?
Yeah. In other words, the water itself becomes acid and it kills everything. There are lakes now that not one fish could live in.
Does it stratify for a short period in the beginning or something?
It depends on, you know. Yeah.
The curvature of the bottom of the lake, and as you said, the composition of the bottom. And
eventually, it mixes. The water in virtually every lake mixes here, which was in Tacoma, was still operating.
I know that.
You would have a serious problem right here.
You know, and the soil types, when you see these, so many charts and maps here and all this stuff, you can't believe it. National Geographic did a great article here on all these things here in December last year. The map showing where the areas are that could be affected do show the Pacific Northwest, and they show the ones that have been affected more and that are really susceptible around Spokane, Washington, in a pretty good sized area there. Something I read a while ago said there are some effects in this area, but as far as the forests in this area, they haven't been hit yet, but they could be. Then they say there's an area around the San Francisco Bay Area and that general area in there also that is susceptible. And part of that, too, they're getting a pretty good load down there in the traffic in California, both in San Francisco and Los Angeles. So it has a great deal to do with how much is generated. Yes?
In Germany, the Black Forest was quite heavily affected by acid rain.
Yes.
And they were doing research to try to get them have it come back. Have they been able to accomplish a particular?
No, they're having very not too much success. And those of you who have been in Germany recently have seen the Black Forest, and that was the first thing that got everybody's attention because it was so bad compared to what it used to be, and it's just been getting worse. And people that analyze wood markets around the world, that's been a factor in increasing the business from Scandinavia into Europe. Anyone planning 5 years ahead is not considering that a big timber source anymore. Yes?
How does this affect the quality of your water, like you say, from the bottom of the lake, where they're dumping in these car bodies to make reefs? The metal, what do you get out of that or from the bodies?
I didn't know they're doing that anywhere. Where are they doing that?
Oh, they're still doing
Norway?
Yeah.
That's why they don't have any junk automobile dealers in Norway.
They're making for the fish. They're dumping their old bodies in.
I don't know anything about that. Do you know anything about that kind of a thing going on?
What effect does that have on the?
Well, it will have some effect, but in most cases, it's not.
The volume wouldn't be.
The volume isn't enough to worry about.
Okay, for a couple of minutes, I just want to tell you a little bit about what's being done now. Yes?
We hear a lot about bacterial engineering to work on various soil toxins associated with everything from radioactivity on down on land masses. Do you know of any research at all that is being pursued that might introduce biological elements into waters with some kind of offsetting impact, in short, eating the heavy metals, for example, on the bottom?
I don't think I know anything about any like that, and I don't think I've read anything about it. You don't know of anything? Evidently not.
Well, there's some bacteria that'll take care of the oil.
Yeah, hear about those.
You know, a few years ago, you heard a lot about, or I did, about Lake Erie, was in Head Lake, and that they've been able to successfully reintroduce life there. Do you know how that was done? Or?
Well, and then the other example out here is Lake Washington.
How do they go
up? Well, they were dealing with a lot of different things other than this. They were dealing with a lot of sewage to begin with, a lot of industrial sewage, and oil, and mercury from the Dow Chemical Company, even the north end of Lake Erie, and
so they just
St. Clair River.
You just curb the pollutants.
Stop it, and then does nature take care of a good share?
Nature can solve a lot of problems. See, one of the problems with Lake Erie is that every time you dump garbage, it takes oxygen. Bacteria have to use the oxygen to get rid of the stuff. Well, there's so much garbage, the oxygen becomes depleted. Therefore, the fish die because there's no oxygen left in the water. So you've got to stop the pollution, and that increases the DO, the dissolved oxygen. Therefore, the life comes back to the lake. That's a relatively simple thing compared to what we're being faced with.
I was at a meeting in Cleveland a little while ago, and they couldn't show me fast enough the river that caught fire. They do that because they're very proud of it. They've got it cleaned up. They want to show it to you. That had a lot of publicity. I was going to say about the research now. There's a lot of research being done by many, many agencies of the government. The Forest Service is dedicating 10% of their research budget to acid rain or acid deposition. It sounds like a big thing, but I heard a speaker recently had a good slideshow and such, and the 10% amount of $13 million a year, well, to me, that's not very much money to be spending on a project this big when you think of how many billions that you're spending on defense. My friend who used to be in the Pentagon says, some guys understand millions, but they don't understand billions. And this is a billion-dollar research situation we're looking at here. And so we have to broaden our thinking. I think our legislators do, too. And it's hard to get legislators to think into the next generation or way out ahead. They're all thinking about the next election year. Then I want to mention just a little bit about all the publicity that's been given to this subject. Then I'd like to swing over a little bit to talk about what interests us most. Some of the national magazines now, they're talking about Planet Earth, and if you walk your way through those magazines, sooner or later, they talk about acid rain. Here's Newsweek of last year, the greenhouse effect, and it ends up here on one page about stretch the limit acid rain, what it's doing to our forest. Here's a picture of the forest in Germany, the Black Forest, and so forth. And it just repeats time after time after time. Everybody's finally agreed that we have this gigantic problem. And now that Reagan's out of the White House, maybe we're going to get some more action on it than we've had in the past. And it was a subject, you know, in the recent meetings in Europe. Here's a thing I picked up. Minnesota, most states have their own thing, acid rain. Minnesota's response tells where it's occurring, what it's doing. Minnesota's very concerned about the Boundary Waters Canoe Area. 1 million acres up there on the Canadian border. About 4 years ago, Canada was going to build a huge power plant just across the border. Nothing was said about it at Anacocan. I don't know if they built that plant or not, but there's sure a lot of material in the newspapers about it for a long time. Here's another one here by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, acid rain effects on fish and wildlife. Here's one, acid rain in Minnesota. And there's the EPA, a very thick report here, acid rain by the Environmental Protection Agency. And I thought if you people come up with a lot of questions today, somewhere in this book there's some answers. They even ask this publication here, which is from the I think EPA also, no, Canadian Embassy, they start off by listing, I think it's about 15 major facts on acid rain. They ask all the questions here, and they go through the book answering all the questions. So what I'm telling you is there's a great amount of material that's been written on this, and now we're getting into the more popular reading, Acid Murder, No Longer a Mystery. This was in Sierra Magazine, I think, reprise. So you get all this coming to you. Here's some more of the graphs and charts that are showing the same things, the air currents and the maps. You see a lot of maps. Here's the one that shows the vulnerable, sensitive areas. And here you'll see the Pacific Northwest and California coast, Canada up here, and then, of course, the great areas in the northeast of the U.S., but I saw some that showed the southeast also. That's put out in Canada. How many lakes? How many more lakes have to die? What a title for a publication. I showed you the white paper. Here's a statement by the Society of American Foresters on acid rain. I'll read you just a few sentences out of that. It more in a conclusion says, many socio-political questions concerning air pollution should also be addressed. These include, but are not limited to, who's going to pay for cleaner air? What level of forest decline is socially acceptable? That's the thing we face in all of these questions. When do you call the fire department, so to speak? What are the economic consequences of regulation on both the polluter and those for whom the forests that are going to receive it? What is the optimum mix between public interest and private rights? Where should continuing research efforts be targeted? At what point do we know enough to begin doing something about the problem? And it goes on along those lines. So you can see that many good minds have given a lot of good attention to this entire subject.
So how did you take all of this together, all that material? What is the bottom line? Where are we? Are we at the bottom of the curve? Are we at the point where it's not going to get any worse, whether it's acceptable now or not, but is it still getting worse? What is the net effect on our national well-being relative to a major diversion of funds from, as you referred to several times over, defense, for example? Where do you see this thing as it comes together as a bottom line?
Well, I guess my personal feeling after kind of being close to this for about a year and a half now, and being to some meetings of technical associations, everything that have talked about it, many of the speakers come on kind of guarded. That after all, we don't know what the phenomena is caused by climatic changes and this and this. But now in the last year or two, I notice they're getting more specific that, hey, we really do have a problem here, and how are we going to get at it? My personal feeling is that it's a lot more serious than people think it is. And I think that if it gets more, a little heavier into all soil types, whether it's forest or agricultural or other places, even wildlife and fisheries and things of this nature, it's going to have a pretty good economic impact. And I suppose that's the way things operate in America until it, you know, hits you in the billfold or somewhere. It doesn't get the real attention. But it has wrecked some of the fishing off the, commercial fishing off the coast of Norway. And it's gotten their attention very much in Europe. And I think Europe is much more attentive to it than the U.S.
I guess what I'm really asking is the degree of pollution we've already created and its impact causing a further deterioration in the environment on a daily or whatever basis? Or are we saying that the new pollution, the mass of pollutants and polluters is growing with no more attention being placed on stopping the problem or correcting what's happened already? Where is the split between what's already happened and what is continuing to be created in the way of pollution? If we stop polluting tomorrow, do we say, well, 20 years from now everything will be fine without any action at all? Or is what's already out there so insidious or so major that the decline in our general living and environment is going to continue?
Want to answer that?
No, I can't answer that.
Can't answer that?
No.
I don't think anybody can really answer it specifically the way you ask it. I think some of it's the damage is done. It's like some other things that we can't go back. And that's sort of what people are saying about the ozone layer too. You know, it's not a matter of waiting to see how bad it gets and then correct it. We should be starting now, and the EPA is tightening down and really tightening down month by month almost on their regulations. They're much more restrictive now in certain industries that I'm familiar with than they were last year. At the end of December, they came out with a whole new set of regulations that have to be implemented by August 1st. For instance, chemical spills used to talk about hundreds of gallons, and they talked about a drum. Now they're talking about 2 gallons. So as they come down like that, it becomes more and more effective. And some industries are just saying you can't operate the way you used to. In some states, as we said the other day, California is getting very, very tough. And I keep saying that other states are going to learn from California, that what they're putting into place now is going to get into place sooner or later in many other states. And people that talk on the other side of the coin say, oh, it's not going to happen here, but I hope it's going to happen everywhere, and it probably will. Excuse me, yes?
They have become so concerned about the ozone effect that they have a national board that's getting together to study it. Is there a possibility that they will convene a national board of the different countries to try to cope with this problem?
They have a group now that's been meeting in Geneva, I think it is, and every country of, what, 18 countries or something have representatives. But all of us know how slow legislation moves. I'm sure they'll come up with something, but when you get an international group like that, they all get it and they all take it back to their own countries, and some of them act faster than others. Many of them look to the United States for leadership in many things, and in some cases we're not the leaders we ought to be.
I agree with that.
Canada, in this case, because it's very, very much at home with Canada, and they really have been pushing it very heavily, and they've got some more stringent laws coming up too.
There are two nationwide networks monitoring the atmospheric deposition in the United States. So, you know, there are measurements being made. That's all I can say. There's another study going on that might get doing great things. They're studying the effect of acid rain on building materials, especially all the limestone buildings in the nation's capital. Mm-hmm.
That's a whole other subject here on this. They show things in Italy.
That may finally get some, some attention at the place where it will do the most good.
I know the National Geographic did quite an article on the that effect in Venice.
Yes. And there's one phase of these writings here is property, what damage is being done to buildings and famous archives and things all over the world. And I think Italy's gotten their share of damage. Just one of, there's another publication I wanted to call your attention. World Watch is an organization headquartered in Washington, D.C. World Watch Institute, and they make publications from time to time on subjects like this. Here's one written called Air Pollution, Acid Rain, and the Future of the Forests. And that was written in 1984. In 1988, this one is called Reforesting the Earth, which deals with these other situations we've talked about also on worldwide forestry and trees.
Those are available in the bookstore.
These are available in the bookstore?
Yeah.
Okay, good. But this is, if somebody wants just background reading, it's good information. Now let's talk for just a minute. Let's see, what time is it? 22. We got about 10 or 15 minutes. As church members, Christians, we're in this beautiful atmosphere out here in Holden, everything looks beautiful. When we go back to our places of business or our homes or to our jobs. What can we do to work to bring this to the attention of somebody? Can we be advocates of anything? Should we encourage our representatives to our church convention that, hey, here's a serious product or subject here. We ought to take a position. I'm not too optimistic what happens at church boards. I was on the Church National Convention, the American Lutheran Church, I think it was about 20 years ago, and they were meeting in Omaha, Nebraska. And at that time, abortion was a great problem in America, you know, and I thought, I'm going to go to this church convention, hear all the debates, and see what they decide and vote on abortion. After about 2 days, they tabled it, and that was the end of that. I don't think they've come out with a policy statement yet. So I don't hold out too much hope for the national church, but I think it's a type of an issue that they could come out with a white paper, just like the American Forestry Association did, stating that, by and large, the church favors legislation that'll get the appropriations, that'll work toward more research on this kind of a social problem that we have. And how can we promote better policy? Well, it's the same story about right to congressmen and all these types of things. Beyond that, these publications tell you how you as a person can help the situation, but their suggestion to me seem a little bit minuscule compared to the major problem, like riding a carpool, four of you in a car instead of one, you know, and don't drive your car when you don't need to. Don't burn your lights any more than you have to, and don't air condition your house when you're not in it, and all these types of things. It just seems to me that's a long way from the real volume problem we've got. I'd like to hear some comments from anybody else here that has thought about this as they go along. Yes?
When the price of gas went way up, people bought littler cars.
Yeah. And now they want a bigger car again, don't they?
Oh, yeah. They're up to back to the V8s. Yeah.
Well, that's the way the thing, the legislation has gone on this in the last 10 years. And you read about, every time you read about new laws on the Clean Air Bill, you know, as the automakers got an extension on when you had to put the catalytic converter on or how much and all that and how many miles a gallon. And they're still working on those things, and they try to push them as much as they can.
We saw the sludge coming out of Los Angeles, and it was, we were 50 miles or so from it, and it was just like being in a fire.
That much smoke, huh?
Yeah.
The smog?
Yeah.
Better watch it. There may be some Californians in here.
No, they couldn't help it. It laid in there for a week.
Oh, yeah.
And then it started away.
It's everywhere. We go up in the mountains and make some kind of a calibration on the smog level in the greater Seattle area. And in the last 20 years, my observation is it's gone up from about 2,000 feet to 4,000 feet.
I see.
Yeah, in the whole Seattle area basin.
When you fly over Seattle or you drive into Seattle and you see the opulent neighborhoods and stuff like that, it just seems to me that you know, our standard of living, living in a consumer society, we're creating a demand for these things, these industries that are polluting our environment. It seems like we have to scale down our consumer mentality. Until we do that, as long as the demand's there, if there's a profit to be made,
Well, see, that's what California's doing. You can't use starter fluid on your charcoal in your backyard now in California. So when they do that, you can't sell it there either. And you can't dispose of certain items by burning them and such in California.
I think you can start somewhere. I was at a big university, and they I don't know how much better. It's probably better to use paper products than styrofoam, which take more petrochemicals to...
Sure.
Develop, and you have to start somewhere.
The church council passed a resolution to ban the use of styrofoam.
Ban the use of styrofoam in your church?
Mm-hmm. And as soon as
you use paper plates, or you use dishes and rewash them, or
that, or paper plates.
Our congregation did that. They were washing plates, and that lasted about as long as the guys that cut their own firewood, about 6 months, and they were back on the paper plates. Yes?
Some people might like to know that Lutheran Brotherhood Insurance has finally put a good deal of money into developing a biodegradable coffee cup. They supply a lot of cups, you know, for church organizations, and they do now have them available.
Biodegradable coffee cup.
They're not the
styrofoam. I don't know if that'll work or not.
They're a more cardboardy type of cup, but they're trying to get away from, or help people get away from styrofoam.
Some of these Norwegians like to use the same cup all day long, you know. They'd be We're running out of time. I think we've gone almost as far as we can go, but since we got such a Norwegian contingent here, I'm going to tell you a little story about a Norwegian logger, and then we'll end up. This guy came from Norway to Minnesota, and he was cutting pulpwood, but they cut all the trees out of Minnesota, so he didn't have a job, so he worked his way down to Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul. Couldn't find a job, so he got to be custodian of the Central Lutheran Church there. And he was sweeping the floors and doing all that work around the church. And the pastor came to him one day and says, I have to make out the Social Security forms and everything here. And here's a form now if you just sign here. And he said, I never learned how to write. Jeg kan ikke skrive. Couldn't sign his name. So the pastor said, gee, that's too bad. You're a nice guy and everything. But when I'm out of the church, you have to take the telephone messages and write them down and leave them for me. So too bad you can't have the job any longer. So he said, that's too bad. So he worked his way on the railroad crews in the Burlington Northern as a tie layer, you know, all the way across America. He got to Seattle, and he got a job on a salmon fishing boat, and it was really going good. They paid by how many fish they caught, and they were catching fish like mad. So you got to be wealthy, and then after a little while, he decided to buy his own floating cannery. So he had to go finance it. He got down to the bank, and they made out all these papers, and the banker says, sign right here. And he says, I can't escriba, I can't sign my name. And the banker says, you've accomplished all this, and you can't write your name. If you could write, there's no telling where you'd be. And he said, I know damn well where I'd be. I'd be the custodian of Central Lutheran Church in Minneapolis. Okay, that's it for today. Thank you all.